Well, good morning. Now, Brother Peter improved this map for us a bit here from the back there. It was kind of hard, especially. So the shaded areas you see here now are water. So if you know that, Persian Gulf, Red Sea, Black Sea, Mediterranean, Atlantic, that kind of gives you a little bit of a better visual there for what's water and what's land. Okay. Well, the message that we just listened to almost disrupted my train of thought. It's so pertinent to our lives, and so many ways I could apply it to my own life that I almost lost train of my own thing here that I'm trying to follow. But one thing I've want to do this morning. So yesterday we talked about some of the things that happened because of the Constantinian change there. We talked about those. We talked some about the Donatists, the somewhat biblical oriented group there, maybe the Paulicans, who seem to be very much a biblical group. We talked some about the monastic movement, the start of the monastery. And so we came a pretty long distance. We came up to about 600, 700, somewhere in there. But there's a few things I want to fill in there before we take it further. So a couple of things that I don't have included, I didn't talk about much, that I don't have included in my notes, I think, is the split between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. So again, the Eastern Church roughly was over here, Turkey, Syria, Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, the North Africa, upward through here somewhere, and the Western Church was over here in Europe. And there were for many, many years, and I forget exactly when it was, I have too many dates in my mind, but for many, many years they were divided. They were virtually divided. They had different languages in their churches. There wasn't much back and forth. There was a patriarch in Constantinople, which is over here in Istanbul now. And then there was the Pope over here in Rome. And there was always these back and forth against each other. And then we talked about Leo yesterday. If you remember, Leo was there in the mid-400s that had gathered more power to the popehood, if you will, he got influence through getting the armies to withdraw from Rome there. Anyway, tried to shore up the whole idea that the Pope is the head. Well, there was a council soon after that that he tried to get the church to agree that the Pope in Rome took precedence over every other bishop or patriarch or whatever, but they didn't do that. They actually said, the guy over here, the patriarch over here, has the same amount of influence or power that the one does in Rome. And so that was all going on at that time. There was this back and forth. The Eastern Church had different beliefs in some ways than the Western Church did. But then in 1054, that split became complete. In 1054, the Pope in Rome excommunicated the patriarch in Constantinople, and he returned the favor and put a curse on the Pope. And that finally, even though it was just a very little thing, and they could have resolved it had they wanted to, they were not peacemakers, and the thing divided the church permanently. And then you had your Greek Orthodox Church and you had your Roman Catholic Church. And that happened in 1054. Now, there were a lot of other things happening in the world that we're going to talk about today through that time and before that time and after that time. But that was what happened there. And there was always a rivalry over here between that. So the emperor was over here. Remember I told you Constantine moved the presidential office over here to Istanbul or Constantinople, as it was called back then, Constantine City. from, it used to be at Rome, and then it was moved over there, but the Pope stayed over here in Rome, and then there was always this back and forth trying to see who had the most power, trying to see who had, the Pope got involved in the affairs of the world, and the Emperor got involved in the affairs of the church, and there was this back and forth that finally culminated then in, I don't know, it was in the 1200s, I think. There was a series of events there that the Pope gathered much more power to himself, and we'll talk about that some this morning. So that, just to let you know that there was always a striving going on there. There's always a fighting going on. The church finally split, and we're going to talk a little bit what happened. By 1328, the Greek church, and so we have Egypt, Israel, Syria, Iraq, Turkey here. Then right in here, there should be a little island. The Cyprus should be right here. And by 1328, the Eastern Church was a little area right here. It had lost everything else. And so that was by 1328. And then by 1453, the Muslims overran Istanbul or Constantinople at that time. And at this point, I think there's only like 15 Orthodox churches, something like that, mostly in that area, right here and in Cyprus, somewhere there. So that was kind of the history in real fast, rough language there of the Eastern Church. Okay. So we're going to move on. All this time that we were talking about yesterday and all this time, there a lot of things are happening in the world, and it's kind of hard. In a way, this is almost as much about geopolitical things as it is about the church, but there were a lot of things happening in this part in Western Europe and up here, Russia, up in here, a lot of things happening, and we'll talk about some of those this morning. But for years, barbarians had been moving into the empire. They'd been moving in from the north, from the east. They've been moving in. Germanic tribes that were up here in this land. Obviously, at that time, it wasn't Germany, France, Spain, Poland. It wasn't like that. Italy was pretty well defined, but there weren't all these geographical lines quite like that. But they were moving in here. For years, they'd been doing that. And as they came down, most of them agreed to be Christians. As they crossed the borders into the empire, most of them agreed to be Christians in order to live in peace. Many served in Rome's armies. Rome still had a tremendously powerful army at the time. This would have been in the late 300s and then into the 400s. But then with time, they started to grow stronger and they started to rebel against Rome's armies. And there was a lot of fighting going on. Then in 400, something happened that shook up this whole area. What happened was way over here in East Asia, there was a group of people called the Huns, and they traveled over into this part of the world and came into Eastern Europe, and they were very skillful, fierce people. They were nomadic people, and they were excellent horsemen. And what happened there was they started to come in here and take over land, and those people that were there, the Germanic tribes, they pushed on over, and it just had a domino effect. They ran away from the Huns, and then these people ran away from these, and it just kept pushing people down into the empire there, and it shook up the whole balance there. Rome had been weakening for years. It had been declining as a world power for years, mostly from inward struggles. from there, the Germanic people couldn't defend themselves from the Huns, and everybody just kept shifting further and further south and west. Well, something was happening that had never happened before. Rome's armies were being defeated on their own land. Now, they had been defeated before, but not on their own land, and they began to be defeated on their own land. I told you yesterday about this Vandal, and I didn't tell you where he came from, but they actually had crossed the Strait of Gibraltar here and lived here, and they came up and attacked Rome. That was that one I told you about yesterday, the Vandal captain that then agreed to not kill or burn the city to kill the people, but rather they looted for 14 days and then went also. So Rome had been suffering a lot of defeats. Now, this empire had lasted for well over 1,000 years, and it slowly died. It wasn't a toppling, it just imploded. It just, from the inside out, almost, it died, it just crumbled. It had seen many victory marches. When they conquered lands, they'd have these triumphal processions through Rome, including Titus when he came back, when he had destroyed Jerusalem. There was a big thing there that in Rome. That city had seen so much of power. And in 476, that Roman Empire ceased to exist. They were no longer a Roman Empire. What happened? I don't have time to go into all that. But basically, they ceased to exist. Now, technically, the emperor was over here, still ruled over this. In reality, he didn't have much power over here. So it gets a little history lesson there. And what happened then, because he had no power, this area over here, like in France, Spain, parts of Italy maybe, it just dissolved into a whole bunch of little kingdoms with a king ruling this area, and it was constantly shifting. And just like, you know, you see a bunch of bulls in a feedlot or something, just pushing each other around, and it's kind of what was happening there. Now, the other thing that I need to talk about is that the western part, and we've talked about this some, I believe, already, but not only did they speak Greek over here and Latin over here, there was a completely different mindset between the two. This was in the church and in an empire both. The Greeks thought more in philosophical terms than the Romans did. They were more, I don't know, they dealt much more in the spirit realm, so their thinking was. And the Greeks were more, tend to be practical and forthright. They had more legalistic idea in the church. And although the church, like I said, remained unified until 1054, they had parted ways long before that, as far as in their thinking. You know, the Greeks in their church, this will give you a little idea, the Greeks in their church saw the relationship between God and man as man was the image bearer. And if you sinned against God, you ruined or you damaged that image. And that image had to be repaired. That's what they thought. The Greeks saw it as a legal agreement between God and man, and the relationship between God and man. They felt if you sinned, you broke that agreement and you had to fix that agreement. And so that was just a little bit of an idea of what their different thoughts were. Later on we'll see some more things. The eastern part gave the church the doctrine of the Trinity, and at the Council of Nicaea they had that understanding of the Son's nature, when there was the argument of whether he is of the same as God or if he is a different substance is God. And that was thinkers from the east that did that. The western part gave the western church many more of its legalistic understandings. So you had a lot of things like the penance, and you had a lot of rites and ceremonies that went with the sacraments and all that. It came from the western thinking. But after the western empire fell, the Eastern Empire continued until 1453. That's when I was talking about when they were overtaken. So this kind of fell. There was barbarian kingdoms here. This was still kind of under the control and rule of the emperor until 1453. Okay. Now, a few hundred years after this, or actually a little over 100 years after this, something else was happening that had a profound effect on the Christian world, and still today has a profound effect on the Christian world. And in 570, there was a baby born to a young woman named Amina, and we don't have... Yeah, it would be down in here. And I'm not exactly sure exactly where it was, but a baby was born in Mecca in Saudi Arabia, and I should have marked that on there, but... And she named him Muhammad. So you see where this is going. But this baby was born there, and his father died around the time of his birth, and his mother died when he was 6 years old. Well, after his mother's death, he had lived first with his grandfather, and then he lived with an uncle till he was grown. He had been in his youth, he was a sheep herder, herded sheep and goats, but he lived with his uncle till he came of age. And when he was of age, or somewhere around there, there was this merchant lady that she was a merchant, and she hired him to run her business for her. And I don't even know what her business was, but I guess just trading in goods and buying and selling. And she asked him to run her business for him, and he agreed. And it seems that at that time, with his traveling as a merchant, it seems that he may have had an exposure to Christians. Somehow he seems to have had exposure to Christians. Later on, he married her. And that gave him financial independence, and he was able to do some other things that he wouldn't had he had to work for his living all his life. But at 25, he married her, and she was probably around in her 40s. But marriage gave him that financial independence. He had the money to do what he wanted to do, and he was a deeply religious man, and so he spent much time alone in the desert. And when he got to 40... he claimed that an angel Gabriel visited him and said, "I am Gabriel, and thou art Muhammad, the prophet of God. Fear not." After that, he spent the next few years establishing himself as a prophet of Allah and became the founder of a religion called Islam, which you know. And Islam means surrender in Arabic, I guess, or whatever it was. But that's what it means, which is interesting. It doesn't seem like... I guess it was expected that other people would surrender. I don't know. But it seemed like he surrendered that much. But he called himself a prophet. And he defended that. He defended that self-proclaimed title prophet. And he shared many more revelations that he got from angels. And I just want to say something about this while we're on this subject. You know, Muhammad told people. He told people that the angel Gabriel had come and told him this. And that... Abner told me that I could preach every once in a while if I wanted to. But anyway, he said that they told him this, and then he had these revelations that he received through angels. And something that, when I was reading this, just stood out to me again is that something I've talked about before and that just keeps stirring my mind sometimes is having the sense of a calling. And see, the thing that I have a problem with him here, and I'm not saying that, I don't want to make a dogmatic statement here, but the thing I have a problem with his thing here, his calling was never confirmed by anyone else. It was simply his idea. It was simply what he said, and it was never confirmed by anyone else. And I would just say this, I think most true callings are always confirmed somewhere else. And so I think that if you feel calling to something, that's great. If you feel calling to whatever it is, prepare yourself. But be careful in moving ahead unless there's confirmation elsewhere. Amen. And I could tell you some stories about things that didn't go so well when people did that. And that's just something I want to throw out there because he didn't do that. And there was no other confirmation. So just be careful with that. Because sometimes feelings are just that. They're just feelings. Okay. So he defended that title. He claimed to be the greatest and final prophet in the line of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Now, he did something there that was very interesting to me. He said that he was the final prophet. See, Jesus... I guess Jesus had done that. I mean, we believe Jesus was the final prophet. But Muhammad wanted to make sure nobody else came along and said, you know, I'm the next prophet, and then have their own version. And so he said he was the greatest and final prophet in the tradition of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. He gained a few followers in Mecca, but like he found out, just as Jesus did, that a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and among his own people. And most of them didn't like him. They run out of town. And In 622, he went to Medina, which I think is the second holy. Some of you probably know better. I think Mecca is like the most holy, and Medina is maybe the second holy. I don't know. There's something there in the Arab world that's connected with that. If I'm not wrong, I read somewhere years ago in the hazy recesses of my mind, I think I remember reading that they think that Muhammad may be descending again at Mecca or something like that. I'll leave you just Arab scholars to answer that question. But from Mecca to Medina was a 250-mile journey. He went there and he was received there as a prophet. And his popularity majorly increased. And all the reason I'm saying all this is because it profoundly affects the Christian world. They accepted him as a prophet and lawgiver, and he promptly turns around, gathers as many people as he can, and goes back to fight against Mecca. He was going to take it back. Well, there were many wars. He won some and lost some. But in Medina, he did something else. He drove out all the Jews, or killed all the Jews, or drove them out that were in Medina at the time. And when I was reading that, I was just thinking how Jesus was talking to the women that were coming after him to the cross. You know, he said, "Weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and your children." And, I have so many facts trying to get in my head. I don't know exactly if I'm placing them the right. I think it was when Jesus said that, but I was just thinking about that the Jews suffered tremendously. Weep for yourselves and your children. 600 of these he personally beheaded, had big trenches dug in the middle of town and brought them out and beheaded them there himself. But towards the Christians, he showed a more lenient attitude. He didn't have the same animosity towards the Christians. Well, finally, 630, he gathered an army of 10,000 men and went down to Mecca and took the city without a fight. Now, as supreme ruler of Medina and Mecca, he soon extended his rule over all Arabia. So he controlled all this area here very soon after that. He died before it went much further, I think, because that was in 630 and he died in 632. But he was constantly announcing additional special revelations from Allah to validate his decrees. So whatever he said was backed up by decrees that had been revealed to him. Meanwhile, over here in the old Eastern Roman Empire, things had been going bad for years. There was a lot of infighting. There was a lot of fighting against each other in the church over some things we're going to discuss a little bit later on. And so they were in no shape to resist anyone. And they had fights over Trinitarian, Christological, anaclastic controversies that divided the kingdom or the empire. And they couldn't. They wouldn't stand together. They wouldn't come together. And the Muslim forces came in there and just easily took that part of the land. And so they came up here and they just started taking land up into Israel, Jordan, all that area there. 2 decades after Muhammad's death, this would be about 650 or 652, the Muslims had conquered Palestine, and they had conquered Syria, and they conquered Egypt, and the whole Persian Empire. And so right here, this area, all this area in less than 20 years was under Islamic control. Most of those lands had been under Christian rule, so the Christians often outnumbered the Muslims. But the Muslims were very lenient against the Christians. They didn't destroy them for the most part. Besides, if they would eliminate the Christians, there wouldn't hardly anybody left. The land would have been forsaken, and they didn't want that either. And the other thing I read somewhere was that the Christians were mostly highly educated, and the Muslims depended on them to produce their writings. Now, I don't know how true that is. That was just something I read. But whatever the case, they did not. They had a better plan than destroying him. You see, most times when there was persecution, the number of Christians increased. Some places where it was especially hard, it didn't. But a lot of places, the persecution increased the amount of people calling themselves Christians. But what they did here instead of that was, Muslims decided that they would allow the Christians to live, but there would be some requirements. They would have to pay tribute, for one thing. And then the other thing they would have to do is they could not build more churches or monasteries. They couldn't do any of that. And they couldn't evangelize. They couldn't make any converts, try to convert anyone to Christianity. So what happened was quickly these places became second rate. Christianity started dying out. As the young ones grew up, Muslims were the rulers. And it just seemed natural to become a Muslim. And so that's how a lot of that died out. And we had talked one of the other days about the fights here between the Donatists and the Catholics. Well, that took care of all that. There's no more fighting there. But they continued to expand through North Africa. They crossed the Gibraltar Strait into Spain. And remember I told you this was unorganized, bunch of little kingdoms up here with kings fighting each other, just constantly changing boundary lines and just, yeah, it was just a real unorganized mess up there because of all that had happened with the Germanic people coming down and Rome falling and all that. So there was just chaos there. And they thought that there would be no problem to cross the Pyrenees into France and then from there on into Europe. That was seemed like a logical plan. And they were planning to do that. But there was one thing that stood between them and that. There was still one well-trained army in France or somewhere. I'm not sure where they were, but they were somewhere here in France. And they were under the control of a man by the name of Charles. And Charles was not a king, but he was part of the royal dynasty that was there at the time. And he managed to halt them here at the Pyrenees Mountains. He managed to halt them. They had horses. He was on foot, but he knew the land and he halted the Muslim advance. And they never went further than that. That's where they stopped. Now this was early in the 700s and Spain. And this is now we're jumping ahead some here, but Spain remained in the grip of Muslims. So this was still is a lot of this, I guess, but Spain remained in the grip of Muslims for many, many years after that, even though they didn't get further north than that. And I think was it 1200 or so, they started driving them out, slowly pushing them back. And it wasn't until 1492 that they finally managed to eliminate them. There was a little area down here called Granada, and they finally managed to push them out of that area. Now, there's an interesting note about that. About the year they pushed them out in 1492, that was done by King Ferdinand and Isabella. Now, does that ring a bell with anybody? That was the same year that the king financed the trip of a courageous explorer that was convinced that the world was round. And so it was the same year he financed Christopher Columbus' trip is when he pushed the Muslims out of the... They were called Moors. If you read about Moors, that's who's talking about. The Islam conquerors there in Spain. But by the 9th century, and this is before this happened, so we're going to go back now. We're backing up a little bit in time. So by the 9th century, the 800s, Muslim, this was all Muslim, all the way around here, all the way up here into eastern Turkey, and down to Saudi Arabia up here. This was all under Muslim control. That was less than 200 years after Muhammad. That was all that. So that's a tremendous, tremendous feat taking all that land. Excuse me. Christianity was almost entirely wiped out of Egypt and North Africa, all the way up the eastern shore. There was no presence anymore of Christianity there. I mean, there were pockets here and there, but it was just without. They just faded out or been killed or converted. But even without the threat of Muslims, the church, like I said, had been struggling for years. There was infighting. There was a lot of things going on there. And they were not prospering at all. I think they said after the time of Constantine, the Eastern Church never produced a theologian. It seemed like they said at one point you could go into, I don't know what time of the period this was, but there was such a debate over Christology who Christ is, or some other things like that, that you could ask a person in the streets any question you wanted to. You could ask them for a drink of water and they'd say, "Who's the Son of God?" They said you could ask whatever question you wanted to, and their response had something to do about one of these debates. I don't know if that's true, but what I was saying is that was the thing that was in everybody's mind, and they were not agreed. One of the controversies that they faced in the Eastern Church, that they did not in the Western Church, was icons. So icons are something that the Orthodox Church, you'll still find them in the Orthodox Church. But icons was a likeness that was carved out of wood of Christ or Mary or the saints or whatever, and they paint them. And that was a holy object. And so if you came in this morning and you were coming in, you would have stopped there at that icon. And I don't know what all you would have done. You would have probably kissed it. And you would have maybe said a prayer in front of it. And the Western Church said, "Now, wait a minute. You're disobeying one of the Ten Commandments. This is a graven image." And so that was the conflict in the church. One of the biggest conflicts that was continuing to weaken the church. And and so in a private, even a private home, you would have had one in your home. You would have had one hanging a certain place. And when you walked in the door, the first thing you would be... If I'd have walked into Brother Abner's house, I would have never even acknowledged Abner until I had gone over and would have crossed myself in front of this thing and bowed to it. And probably, I don't know if they kissed it in the personal homes. And then I would have greeted Abner. So that was a place that icon had in the church. And this was a very, very controversial subject because some, I'm not talking about the Western church, but some in the Eastern church felt like it was also idol worship. Even today, the first worshiper that comes into an Orthodox church will light a candle and walk over to where it is, put it in front of the candle, and they'll kiss it, and then they'll say a prayer. That's what they'll do. Well, in 717, the Emperor Leo III set out to... He came from the Taurus Mountains, is where he was raised, and he set out to do away with the icon in the church. He was against those things, and it's very interesting. Yesterday, if you'll remember, if you were paying attention yesterday, we talked about the Paulicans. And the Paulicans, you remember the story about Constantine that changed his name to Silvanus and then was killed by his adopted son. And then Simeon, after he was converted, took the name of Titus and kept on with his work there in Armenia and Kilbasa. Well, this was the same area that Leo was from. And it's interesting that he also, from that area, had this aversion to the relics because, or not the relics, but the icons, because that was one thing that, Silvanus had really preached against, that all those were really against that kind of thing. And so some people think, historians think, that he was influenced by the Paulicans. So there's no way of knowing that. But he set out to destroy the use of icons as an idol worship. He was the emperor there. And the 750s, he was an emperor there. Over here in Constantinople, and he was going to deal with this, and that struggle continued for years. The clergy and the monks rebelled. One reason the monks were so hard against this is because the monks carved these things and painted them and made money off of them, and so they were very against these, and the clergy was against them, and there was violent protests going on. But the struggle continued for years, and in 754, they called a council, an ecumenical council, to deal with this, and they said, okay, this is it. No more icons worshipped in the Eastern Church. That's it. It's not the churches, the council has spoken, and it was prohibited. That didn't end things. I mean, the struggle went on. There was still fighting going on, and this is one reason why it was so easy for the Muslims to just take over the country. But then things changed after, so it was Leo III, and then it was his son that took up the fight. But after his son died, his son's wife had a totally different view of the thing. She appreciated these things. And so she worked vigorously to reverse all those situations. And finally they called another council in 787, and then they made the decision it could be worshipped again. And that was largely based on some writings by a man named John of Damascus that justified all their worship and said, look, we're not really worshiping graven images. This is just a reminder of the person behind the image. Our worship just goes to the person behind the image, Christ, Mary, the saint, and doesn't actually, not actually worshiping this image. Well, the battle continued, but the image worship prevailed. And like I said, it's still going if there's an Orthodox church. And it prevailed. So that was one thing that was in the Eastern Church that was never in the Western Church. The Western Church had their crucifixes. They had their relics under the altar, their bones of the saints and whatnot they had, but they didn't have the images. Okay, meanwhile, who all's heard of the Vikings? Somebody heard, oh my, everybody's heard of the Vikings. Okay, the Vikings were from way up here, Norsemen. They came from the north. They were up here in Norway and Sweden. And they brought their share of troubles to Europe. But they came down, the historians say, or some of the people writing in that time say that it just seemed they just like killing for killing. They just like that. They like that just for the sake of doing it. But they came down. And they sailed their boats, and they came down here. Let's see, this map is a little off. Germany would be going up here, but they sailed down. They went everywhere. They took parts of the UK, Ireland, and they come down, sailed around here, come down in this side, went up into France, Spain, all the way up. I mean, they just, the whole land for years, the people in that land lived in fear of the Vikings coming in. And they just destroyed. But in time, they started to stay there. And there's probably a lot of areas that still have some of their descendants. Actually, if you know, France has an area called Normandy, and that would be I think if you read World War II history, you would hear a lot about Normandy. But Normandy, France, was the area that these Norsemen settled. That was why it's called Normandy to this day. But they were all over the place. And then some came. The other thing that some did, and this map is not quite, Russia goes up over here, but they came in over land and down the rivers through Russia all the way down through here. And they also settled in Russia. And the reason we're going in all this history about the Vikings is because it connects with the church here. This all happened in 832. So we had the Vikings coming in here from up here, sailing in here, taking over a lot of land, just raiding, pillaging, just doing whatever, the killing. There's just no end to their atrocities. And then they come down this way. There's some that stayed up in Russia. And some of this is hard to prove, but somewhere around 900s, early 900s, in Russia, in a place called Kiev. I don't know if it's the same Kiev, which would be in Ukraine now, but there was a young man there by the name of Vladimir, and his grandmother believed in God. And I don't know how sound her faith was, but she believed in God. Now, they were Norsemen. They were Vikings, and they had all kinds of idols and things, but it is said that Vladimir wanted a religion. He was looking for a religion. He heard about this God. He was looking for religion that he could bring back. And so what happened was, he started looking at religions. And again, this can't be proven. It's not really assumption. It's based on things that were written that can't be proved. It's tradition that's been handed down. But not that they were there, but that what this thinking happened. So he rejected Judaism because he felt like their God had forsaken them and that he didn't want to give up pork. He rejected Islam because he didn't want to give up alcohol. He figured out, and this is shocking to us, but he figured out Christianity had the least amount of things he'd have to give up. And that's not doing well for us, is it? But anyway, it says he chose the Greek instead of the Western Christianity. He chose the Eastern because his grandmother had prayed for him to the Greek Orthodox God, and he had been healed of an eye disease. And besides that, he liked the Greek liturgy, which is the formal things they say in their service. He liked that, and he also liked the Hagia Sophia. Some of you have been in there. I've been in that place in Turkey. He just liked that. As a matter of fact, the man who built it, they say, once it was built, this was a huge church. Orthodox Church is now a mosque, but back then it was a huge church. They said when he was done building it, he said, "I have outdone Solomon." So that was some of the reasons that Vladimir chose to take that religion up there. Now, some of these reasons may be more legend than fact, but whatever the case, in 988, Vladimir put away his seven wives and many concubines and married the sister of the emperor, Basil, that lived here. He married his sister. She was a Christian. And he got baptized the same day. And he set about ridding the land of idols. Now, remember, he was not down here. He just married a girl from down here. And they think the Crimea Peninsula might have been her dowry, but they were somewhere here is where he was. And they say they dragged the idols through the streets, and the people flogged the idols as they went past and whipped them, and then when they got to the river, they chucked them in the river. So that's how he got rid of the land of the idols out of the land. But then he ordered all his men, or all his people actually, to show up on the bank of the river, and then when he stood up here on the cliff reading the baptismal words, those armed soldiers herded him into the water. And just baptize them. Just do it all at once. Christianize the whole nation in 15 minutes. So that's kind of what was happening there. But it seems that in some ways he was very, very sincere. I mean, just the fact that he put away his wives and concubines. And so it seems that he was very sincere. And I don't know, the man may be in paradise. I don't know. I'm not judging whether he was or not. But he had 400 churches built, I think, by the time of his death. There were something like 400 churches built. And then his son built him in this magnificent cathedral, patterned after the Hagia Sophia, which means the Church of Holy Wisdom, by the way. But the reason I had brought that all that into it, because that was one place that was still connected. So you had this pocket, this small pocket here of your Greek your Greek Orthodox, and then this, you had a bigger area up here that was the same. But by 1500, the churches of Russia had completely separated from the churches down here. By that time, there wouldn't have been churches here. There would have been some churches here and right here in this area. But he had completely separated from those, and they had completely separated. They became welded to the Tsars and were hereafter called the Russian Orthodox. And if I'm not wrong, you can still see some of their distinctive churches, cathedrals there. I don't know. Some of that stuff, I didn't follow their history. I was just, the only interest I had in it was how it tied in with the history down here. Through much of the 9th and 10th centuries, Europe stayed in constant upheaval. They were plagued by the Vikings and the Magars. They're over here, there was another group of people, the Magars, that came in and attacked a lot of Italy there. And they were plagued by these to no end. And they were just, I mean, life was just about survival. That's all it was about. There was nothing more that they could do, just survive. Through these centuries is when feudalism rose up, if you know what feudalism is. It has, you know, your king at the top or your ruler at the top, and then it has the nobles underneath that, and then it has the soldiers, professional soldiers, and finally the peasants and serfs. And it's all interdependent on each other, that whole system is, but obviously the people at the bottom get squashed the hardest. And it led to some of the peasant revolts later on, but we're not going to talk about that. But that was the system because there was no other government. People weren't wondering which political party to vote for. They just wonder if there was a political party at all, if there was anybody that was in control of anything. This would have been through the 9th and 10th centuries, the 8th and 900s. It just stayed in constant upheaval. But it became that feudalism became the only form of government. And you had your king up here at the top. He was the only one that didn't have anybody above him. The peasants were the only one that didn't have anybody underneath of him in the hierarchy of how they had that set up. And if we had time, I'd draw a picture up here. But they all depended on each other. Maybe I should explain that a little bit. So if you read about feudalism, you maybe have a little bit of a idea. So the king or whoever was at the top, he gave land to the ones below. And over here on the other side, they provided service such as fighting for him. And then these gave land to the next ones. And these provided fighting for them. And finally, the peasants didn't get land, but they got the right to work on land to work on. And they had to give a lot of what they worked on to the next level up. And so it was a very unbalanced thing. And the peasants really, really suffered under it. But it was one way to keep some semblance of form of government there. As I said earlier, in the midst of all this, and I know this is a lot of world history, but in the midst of all this, let's see, what does it say there in Peter? So John D. must have been preaching about virtue, right? Because now we're adding knowledge, right? Is that what we're doing here? In the midst of this, the Pope and Emperor were constantly still just back and forth. It was this constant struggle. Now the Pope was on top. Now the Emperor was on top. But in the late 19th century, or the 13th century, sorry, the late 13th century, Pope Boniface VIII issued a document known as the Unum Sanctum. Saying that right? Unum Sanctum? Unum Sanctum? I don't know how to say it. Issued this document. I'm going to read just a little bit out of this document to give you an idea of how the Pope saw himself at this time. And we need to move on. I was hoping to talk about some others here yet, some of the remnant. It included these words: "We are obliged by the faith to believe and hold, and we do firmly and sincerely confess that there is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic church, and that outside this church there is neither salvation nor remission of sins. At the time of the flood, there was one Ark of Noah, symbolizing the one church, and one, namely Noah, as helmsman and captain, outside of which all things on earth, we read, were destroyed." So they're just building the case that just one. "Thus, concerning the church and her power, is the prophecies of Jeremiah fulfilled. See, I have this day set thee over nations and over kingdoms." That's interesting in light of Jesus' words. "For this authority given to man and exercised by man is not human, but rather divine, given at God's mouth to Peter and established on a rock for him and his successors, in him whom he confessed, the Lord saying to Peter himself, whatsoever thou shalt bind," etc., etc. You know that verse there. "They said then, whosoever therefore resists this power ordained by God resists the ordinance of God. Furthermore, we declare, state, define, and pronounce that it is altogether necessary to salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." And so they built this case where if you were not under the Roman pontiff, you were lost. There was no hope. And they used that weapon effectively for many years. They would put whole countries into what they called an interdict, I believe is the way you say it, where they weren't excommunicated, but they could not receive, they could receive the infant baptism, the christening, and they could receive the extreme unction, but they couldn't receive the sacraments of the Lord's Supper and some of those things, and so they couldn't be saved. And so they used this effectively, and there's actually a very sarcastic writing by one of the more biblical, I don't know if you call them biblical, but one of the writers that pictures this thing where one of these popes winds up in front of God and is demanding to be entered in. If he's not, he's going to put St. Peter into interdict and he's going to excommunicate him and all. And so anyway, this was the teaching of the church. It was you could not be saved, and it took away completely the need for Jesus Christ. There was absolutely no need for him. And people grew up thinking that forgiveness was from the Pope. And we don't have time to talk about penances and indulgence and all that. We'll talk about the Crusades just real quick. There were five or six major Crusades that happened. The Crusades were basically, the word Crusade meant War of the Cross. And what had happened when the Muslims had overtaken this part of the world. For many years after that, the pilgrims or the Christians could still make pilgrimages to the Holy Lands. They could still go worship at the shrines, the Gethsemane, whatever they went to worship there. They could still do that, and the Muslims were just fine with it. They didn't bother them. But by 1070, the Seljuk Turks, which were also Muslim, took over there and they started harassing them. And then Pope Urban II, he got all fired up about this and he called all his men to gather up and go fight and kill these, and said that they were fighting with each other. And he said, let the people turn their weapons dripping with the blood of their brothers against the enemy of the Christian faith. Let them hasten, if they love their souls, under their captain Christ to rescue the land of Zion. And he offered them plenary indulgences, which means that if you go on this crusade and you kill the Muslims and you deliver the city of Jerusalem, that means that your loved one that has died, that's now in purgatory, and if you want to know what purgatory is, I don't have time to explain it, but it will immediately free him from that. He can be out of purgatory just like that if you go on this crusade. Well, they went in a crusade and they took parts of Palestine and they killed Muslims by the thousands and hundreds of thousands. The guy that wrote the record of that said the blood went to the bridle reins of the horses in the city when they went in there. And so there was just massive massacre that the Christians were doing against the Muslims. The interesting thing is they destroyed a whole villages of Jews before they ever left to Europe. So it wasn't just crusades against the Muslims. They had killed many, many Jews, slaughtered whole villages before they ever left. Okay, well, we don't have time to go on this, the rest of this. I'll have to try to cover some of this tomorrow, I guess. Tomorrow I was hoping to deal mostly with the reformers. I think that we need, I think there's a need to maybe do a little bit of explaining who the reformers were, because I think in most of our minds, we don't know the difference between the reformers and the Anabaptists. In the beginning, I think there's been some problems sorting all that out. So I want to address that tomorrow, and maybe I'll try to fit some of these things in here that I didn't get to today. Let me see if there's... Oh, one thing I want to say, I'll just say this real quick. There was something else called the Inquisition that the Catholic Church did against what they called the heretical sects, like the Waldensians and those. But it was the Dominican monks that did it. They went into these places and they questioned people. And if you had a problem with somebody, this was an excellent time to get rid of them. Because all you had to do was go to them and say, look, that guy's a Christian. I know he is. And if they would never tell you if you were accused, they never tell you who accused you, what you were accused of. But if you didn't immediately say that you were not, or that you pledged allegiance to the Pope or whatever, you'd probably be killed. But and that's a very, very simple explanation. It's much more complex than that. But what I want to say about that, one way the church tried to combat heresy. There was another way they tried to do it, was by having monks act just like the Waldensians. They lived very, very separated lives. They went around preaching two by two. They did these. And one of those monks was called Francis. Francis of Assisi, I think he says. And just an interesting note about that. That was one of the church's ways to combat heresy. And the only reason I mention him is because I believe in John Dee's songbook, we have at least one song that he wrote. And there's several others in there I could talk about in that book that were also in the history of the church. But anyway, I'll have to leave some of that till tomorrow. And if you have any questions that you want to know more about, I'd be happy to explain them. I just don't have the time here. Thank you.